Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Who can you trust? Mom, dad, sister, brother, husband, wife? Of course. Babysitter? Hopefully. Butcher? Yeah, why not? Baker? Sure. Banker? Mutual fund manager? Not sure. What's going on here?
The credibility problem causes people to have less confidence in Wall Street, less confidence in everything.
Thank you to my friend in the barbershop. Credibility, trust, confidence, all vanishing in a cloud of foreclosures, bank failures, and stock market free falls. How did we get here? Writer Margaret Atwood looks to history, literature, and language.
Currency only means something when it's flowing, when the currency is a current.
Who can you trust? It's the question we're asking and trying to answer on this special edition of Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Welcome to a special edition of Marketplace Money and to our voice mailbox.
Our financial planner has not returned our emails, and we're getting quite concerned.
My husband's afraid to put money into the market right now. I kind of think that he should anyway.
A year ago, I opened an annuity. How safe is it?
They want to close one of the investment options, and they're saying we have to pull out. Is that legal?
Are these reputable companies to deal with?
All I would like to know is where I can get authoritative information.
I'm just concerned.
This financial mess has a lot of you worried, questioning who you can trust. So we're devoting this hour to that question. Who can you trust? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
Today, our special coverage continues of Fallout, America's financial crisis, and I'm joined this week by my colleague and the host of Marketplace, Kai Rizdahl. Nice to have you with us, Kai.
Tess, great to be here.
Listeners, as you know, have been flooding our inbox with hundreds and hundreds of questions about their bank accounts, their retirement accounts, the state of the U.S. economy. Is your money safe? Should you stop contributing to your 401k?
Are we heading toward a recession? Can the bailout plan work? Do we need another government stimulus package to boost the economy? Where's all that uncertainty coming from? Just look at the last week in the stock market. Triple-digit gains, triple-digit losses. We got it all. And don't think it's passing you by. The Congressional Budget Office says we've collectively lost $2 trillion in our retirement accounts over the past year.
Ouch. And, you know, the anxiety seems to boil down to one word, Kai. Trust.
Yeah.
So today on A Special Marketplace Money, we ask, who can you trust? Financial institutions? Government leaders? Bankers? Your financial planner? Who will keep your money safe, your retirement income intact? We're going to have some answers to those questions, plus some specifics on managing your bottom line. And Kai is here to do what he does every day on Marketplace. Give us a little bit of the broader economic and political picture.
Because the global economy is changing by the day, and on some of those days, it truly is changing by the hour. Given that, can you trust that some of the most important elements of your financial life are going to be safe over time? We just had the last presidential debate, all economy, all the time. The election itself is just a couple of weeks away. But can we believe candidates will give us the truth in the middle of a campaign and a crisis? And can we expect financial leaders to do the same? What will you have to sacrifice that they aren't telling you about? We'll get to those questions during the next hour. Tess?
Thanks, Kai. And we will also get to your personal finance questions with our own Chris Farrell. Listeners from across the U.S. want to know, who can I trust? It's all coming up on this special hour of Marketplace Money. We're going to start things off here with another question, which is, what are you doing? Yes, you, and lots of other people who are deciding whether to change the way they save and invest. We'll hear from them throughout this show and other Marketplace programs. To kick it off, we turned to a familiar voice who's dealt with budgets big and small.
I'm Robert Reich, professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and this is what I'm doing. I'm feeling cautiously pessimistic about the economy. I worry that there's not sufficient demand out there in terms of purchasing power among the great middle class to keep the economy going. Although I do have a history of buying high and selling low, I'm just basically keeping my equity shares of stock where it is. And any new earnings I have, any new savings, anything that I can put away, I'm putting into money market funds and CDs. I don't even want to think about what's happened to my finances since last September. I carefully avoid looking at the reports that come in on my 401k. I just don't want to be aggravated. Hopefully, God willing, there'll be enough years between right now and when I retire that I won't have to be aggravated. I'll just look at it when times get better. Maybe the only thing that's stayed the same is me. I'm not a big spender. I don't go out to a lot of fancy restaurants or buy big things. There's something in the back of my mind, and I'm sure that I'm not alone, that says, if you don't have to spend money, don't spend it.
That was Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Marketplace Money is supported by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
All right, let's get back to this question of trust. One thing we've always assumed we could count on was our checking and savings accounts, CDs and the like. Banks are fortresses of safety, literally and figuratively, right? And if something happens to your bank, you've got the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation backstopping it, right? Well, we wondered who's backstopping the backstop. Where's that money coming from? William Isaac served as chairman of the FDIC in the early 80s. And Mr. Isaac, did you see anything like this current situation during your term?
The banking industry is in much better shape than it was in the early 1980s. But yet we have this widespread instability in the financial markets. That's the big distinction between the two eras.
Can you compare the bank failure issue for us? How bad is it right now compared to what it has been?
Well, it's not very bad at all. We've had two large ones go, IndyMac and WaMu, but there's only 117 banks on the problem list right now. That number will grow, but 117 is somewhere close to a record low, whereas the period from 1980 to the end of 91, we had 3,000 bank and thrift failures. Plus, we still had 1,500 banks on the problem list at the end of that period. So this is a much tamer sort of problem right now in terms of the banking industry itself.
Yeah, interesting to get a little perspective there. As you know, we are looking at the issue of trust, and we want to get to the question of how and why we can trust an agency like the FDIC. And to get to that, I want to first ask you, where does the FDIC get its money to insure our bank accounts?
Well, in the first instance, the FDIC gets its money from the banking system. The banks pay premiums to the FDIC. And at the beginning of this year, the FDIC had approximately $52 billion that it had accumulated from the banks. But it's important for me to add that the FDIC, by law, is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. So when people say, well, can the FDIC fail? Can it run out of money? And the short answer to that question is no.
How does that work? How do we know that the money will actually be there if the very worst were to happen and all kinds of banks went under?
Well, it has to be there because the country can't function without a strong banking system. It just no country can. Nobody should have any doubt that the government will back up the banking system and the FDIC in particular, because the government has no choice.
I guess I am still trying to get at the kind of worst case scenario. You know, I wonder if you can tell us that the FDIC, when it promises to back up $250,000 for every depositor in this country, can it literally do that?
Yes, because it's inconceivable that every bank in the country, or even a large number of banks in the country, would fail at any given time. If you believe the FDIC is not going to make it, then what you're saying is that the U.S. is not going to make it.
Bill Isaac is currently the chairman of the Secura Group, a private financial firm. He was chairman of the FDIC from 1981 to 1985. Thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
The FDIC is maybe the government agency we're most worried about whether we should trust or not. But if you really want to explore the idea of trust in modern government and financial institutions in this country, you have to go back a ways to the guy who figured out why we needed the FDIC and massive government intervention in the first place.
My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking. To talk with the comparatively
FDR gave his first fireside chat 8 days after he was inaugurated.
He was able, in his fireside chats in particular, to give Americans a sense of not only that the only thing they had to fear was fear itself, but that there was somebody in the White House who understood what they were up against and he was going to do something about it.
Princeton historian Sean Wilentz will be our guide during this short primer on trust and confidence in this country.
By the time we got out of World War II, and when an entire generation of American men and women came back wanting what was called normalcy. Things had been so abnormal for so long. So under those conditions, and amid the economic boom of the 1950s and early 1960s, faith in the financial order, trust in the corporate structure was reinforced.
Still, for all that trust, people were plenty nervous. A Gallup poll in August of 1946 showed 60% of the country was expecting another Great Depression within the next 10 years. What they got instead was 20 years of unprecedented economic prosperity and then a decade of political turmoil.
Vietnam and Watergate combined managed to blow the center out of the American political system in both political parties. And that level of mistrust generalizes out so that basically anybody in public life is not to be trusted.
With that as backdrop, then, let's skip right over Richard Nixon saying he's not a crook and Jimmy Carter promising he'll never lie to us and interest rates shooting up to the high teens by the middle of 1981. And cut straight to the spring of last year, and Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, trying to predict the future.
The impact on the broader economy and financial markets of the problems in the subprime market seems likely to be contained.
Contained, he said. Sure, it was tricky for the Fed chairman to know exactly how the subprime crisis would play out, but the point is we all trusted him. Investors sure did. The Dow hit its record high 6 months after he gave that testimony.
For complicated, extremely complicated global economic and political worlds in which, such as we live in today, I mean, unless you can be sure that the person who you're talking to is going to deliver on what he or she says he's going to, you're not going to be able to do anything.
And then there's this, drawn from the headlines just a week ago, a press conference by Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson.
This action plan provides a coherent framework that will direct our individual and collective policy steps to provide liquidity to markets, strengthen financial institutions, protect savers, and enforce investor protections.
So how do you trust somebody when you have a hard time figuring out what they're saying?
Well, that's a big problem. And yes, I think one of the problems that we have today is that, well, it's twofold. One is I don't think that the policymakers can entirely understand what's going on, but they certainly do a less than admirable job of explaining what they do understand. So people are petrified at the moment.
I asked Wilentz whether it's possible to get that trust and confidence that's gone back. And he said, sure. All it would take is somebody who could do what FDR did.
When it comes to trust, you'd better feel good about the guy who takes a razor to your neck. Voices of Reason from the barbershop.
Everybody comes in here, investors, bankers, lawyers.
Our special coverage of the financial crisis continues. Who can you trust? We're searching for answers on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and joining me throughout this hour of special coverage of the financial crisis is my colleague and the host of Marketplace, Kai Rizdahl.
Tess, as you know, we're focusing on the issue of trust this week. Can we trust our banks, Wall Street, even really the government? You just came back from 10 days out on the road, Tess, talking with people all over the country. What did you find when it came to this very important question of trust?
Very, very interesting. Kai, you know that saying on Wall Street about taking a haircut?
Yeah. Basically, if you have investments, you've probably taken one. That is to say, a loss, and usually a big one.
Right. Well, last week I visited with some folks who are taking haircuts on Wall Street and on the corner of Franklin and Madison Streets in Jefferson City, Missouri. Trust comes into play the moment anyone takes a seat in one of Rich McCarty's barbershop chairs.
Military style or civilian style, Bob?
Military.
Okay.
That's one close shave for Bob Snyder, an IT consultant in Jefferson City. He's been getting a military-style buzz from McCarty since 1994.
He's always a good source of information, because as he was telling you earlier, everybody comes in here, investors, bankers, lawyers.
They come for the cuts and also for a little stock talk from McCarty and from CNBC, which squawks from a nearby television as he wields his razor.
The yields are going back up on the treasuries, and as a result, you have as an indication of an increased risk appetite as we watch.
McCarty is 61, started barbering in Jeff City, as he calls it, in 1965. He's also a longtime investor who's seen this kind of turmoil before.
Last year, I had 28 stocks as of October. I am down to two stocks right now, and I just bought them in January. The markets are going to come back. They always do.
He says his broker thought he was crazy when he sold off most of his stocks at the start of the year. I remembered what happened in March of 2000, he says, that dot-com bust, so I sold. Right now, he's just breaking even. And he's trusting that the market meltdown will eventually work itself out.
There's nothing I can do about it. I can't do anything. So why worry about it? I mean, worrying about my money ain't going to do anything. It might give me an ulcer, then I have to pay a doctor. So I can't do anything. I don't worry about it.
Neither does customer Bob Shepker. He's 71, been coming here for, 20 years at least, he says. And he's watching as the markets lurch from one piece of bad news to another.
It bothers me, but it don't really scare me because I think, you know, we need to just ride it out. That's all I don't want to do. People sell out now, they're going to lose their money too. So I guess it's a risk one way or the other.
Are you retired at this point?
Yes, I am.
Do you have any money in stocks right now, or have you moved everything to safety?
No, I've got money in stocks.
Yeah.
He's also got a state pension and Social Security to live on while he rides it out. Bob Snyder, still in the barber chair, says the investment club has lost almost 20% off the value of its holdings.
But we expect that to go back up. And we try to look for a stock that's going to grow 15% a year.
Is there anything like that these days?
No, not really. But I think fundamentally things are still good here. And I think that the banking system is going to come back. As much of anything, it's a credibility problem right now. And that the credibility problem causes people to have less confidence in Wall Street. Less confidence in everything.
That's a great haircut.
Yeah. Now the good part.
$11 haircuts. How about it?
They went up $1 this year.
Thank you, Bob.
Yes, haircuts went up $1 to 11 bucks this year. Inflation has come to Rich McCarty's barbershop. And by the way, he says he's much more concerned about that than what's happening on Wall Street. And he's annoyed that the Fed lowered interest rates to help out banks, even with inflation on the rise.
Law of supply and demand takes care of everything. If they just stay out of it, it will take care of it. But we try to manipulate everything.
Meanwhile, 74-year-old Bob Sim, yes, there were three Bobs in the barbershop, he sat quietly observing Bob Snyder's haircut. Sim is a retired accountant who now advises investment clubs. And he, too, says he's seen all this before, and he trusts that there will be yet another rebound, eventually.
The value of my security, my portfolio has gone down, of course. But if I don't sell anything, then I don't lose anything. It'll be back.
In fact, he's so convinced of that, aside from Social Security and his pension, he has 99% of his nest egg still in stocks. I asked if he thought everyone should just chill, like him.
I mean, everybody's got a different mentality. They look at it differently. And some people are not going to be able to withstand what's going on. They're going to sell. And some folks are going to sit around like me and just watch it go up and down.
And you don't lose sleep at night?
Not a bit. Cat might keep me up, but not stock market.
Cat might keep me up, but not the stock market. That's trust.
There are a lot of comparisons being made between what's happening now and what happened to get us into the Great Depression. You heard the FDR tape in the first part of the broadcast and how the country trusted him to get us out of it. What we thought we'd do now is look at those comparisons and how or whether we can trust either man running for the White House today to do the same thing. For that, we've called Stanford University historian David Kennedy. Professor Kennedy, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
In terms of the scope of history, how well positioned are we with this administration to deal with this economic crisis?
Well, I don't know that the question really goes to this administration so much as it goes to just the structure of the federal government that we now have. There's a world of difference between the array of apparatus and devices, instruments, institutions that the federal government now commands to deal with a crisis like this, which is why I keep telling people that we're not likely to see a catastrophe on the scale of the Great Depression, particularly not something of the duration of the Great Depression, which was more than a decade.
What do you think would be the first move then for the next president come the 20th of January?
I think clearly the steps that have been taken already to stabilize and liquidate the banking system, liquefy the banking system, maybe I should say. And not least of all, I think most importantly, the steps that have been taken in the direction of international cooperation, multinational cooperation to deal with this, are initiatives that were all but impossible in the context of the 1920s and 1930s, and already give me at least some reassurance that governments around the world have got the not only the instruments but also the political will to come to grips with this.
You know, during the debates, both candidates have been asked what they're not going to be able to do policy-wise because of the economic crisis. And yes, they're politicians and they won't ever tell you what they're not going to be able to do. But doesn't there have to be an acknowledgement that we can't do everything we want to do?
Well, you would think so. It seems to make common sense that there's only so much money, so much fiscal power, so much taxing authority out there. And so a lot of things that are being promised aren't going to happen. On the other hand, if we think back to the big one, the Great Depression of the 30s, it was in that context that we put in place the largest and still the largest entitlement program in our political landscape, which is Social Security. So governments are not without resources and without the capacity to do some pretty dramatic things, even in the context of great financial constraint.
Let me do another compare and contrast with FDR's time and the present day. Federal government, obviously, today is much more wide-reaching. It has greater scope. It's got greater liabilities. Is that a help or a hindrance in figuring out how we can trust people to manage this and go forward?
The scope of the federal government's activities today in the economy as a whole, you're absolutely right, are incomparably greater than they were in the 1920s and 30s. And that provides, it seems to me, some very solid ballast for the economy going forward. Again, not least of all, just from the simple fact of Social Security payments, which not only more or less guarantee the elderly that they have at least a floor of income beneath them, but also in the aggregate, Social Security payments do a lot to maintain at least some minimum level of consuming power. So I think here's another measure of the difference. Federal expenditures in 1930, in the middle of the Hoover presidency, amounted to about 3% of GDP. Today, federal expenditures on the whole are about 20% of GDP, but roughly seven times greater presence in the economy as a whole. That's simply not as vulnerable to contraction and disappearance as is, for example, private investment.
David Kennedy, professor of history at Stanford University. Professor Kennedy, thanks a lot for your time.
Very nice talking with you, Kai.
And now the second installment of our series, Here's What I'm Doing. Here's a guy who's taking action with his pad and pencil.
I'm Bob Mankoff. I'm the cartoon editor of the New Yorker magazine, and I've also been a cartoonist for the magazine since 1977, and I think that probably comprises three or four previous financial crises. What I'm doing today is looking at for the funny side of finance and finding it. I always feel upbeat when times are downbeat because that's one of the functions of humor, to cope and to not only see the lighter side but to see the perspective on everything. I did a cartoon in 2 weeks ago when we ran all financial cartoons where it's a woman saying to sort of a fat cat guy, a banker, can you make a living at that? Another cartoon that I think summarizes actually most people's feelings is a guy in a boardroom saying, and while there's no reason yet to panic, I think it only prudent that we make preparations to panic. So I think even though we'll all be poorer, this is all rich fodder for a humorist. One of the things that's been asked is, who can you trust? I actually think you can trust the humorists. One of the functions of humor is as a sort of rough-and-ready BS detector.
Bob Mankoff is the cartoon editor at The New Yorker. Check out some of the cartoons at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
It is time for Getting Personal, and this week, as we all know, we are asking the question, who can you trust? Well, I've got a sure thing. You can trust our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
Hello, Tess, and thank you very much for that.
You are most trustworthy, my friend. As you know, questions continue to pour in during this economic crisis. Lots of people rethinking their investment strategies, and that includes the rethinking of the age-old wisdom that it is always a good idea to max out your retirement accounts, those 401k and IRA funds. Let's go to Linda in Weymouth, Massachusetts. She wrote in wondering if she should be using those funds for something else.
I'm considering stopping making regular contributions to my Roth IRA because our Roth IRA is losing money, and it feels as if we're just putting money into something that just is losing. It feels like throwing money away. We contribute $650 a month. I'm not sure. It's a hard thing.
So I just want to keep it really simple, ran some numbers. So here are the assumptions that I made, that we have $20,000 in the IRA because she's been making contributions, right? So we use some sort of money, and going to retire at 65 because forget 60. I think that's one of the new rules that's coming out of this whole turmoil. Start using 65 as your normal retirement age. And then I just assumed 5% rate of return over 35 years, 5% average annual rate of return. That seem fair to you?
Yeah, it seems fair to me. Actually, it sounds really good to me right now.
Right now, it sounds very good. So you run that number, and she has a bit over $600,000 when she retires at 65. Now, she's nervous. She has her $20,000 in there, but she doesn't want to contribute any money, and she doesn't contribute any new money for the next 5 years. And then 5 years from now, starts putting the maximum in. So we do the whole thing. The gap, she has $120,000 or approximately $120,000 less in her retirement account by simply waiting those 5 years.
Ouch.
That's a big number. I mean, to me, that's a big number. To me, the bottom line is the power of compounding over time. Even if you use a 3% number, the gap still exists.
And one thing that I keep telling myself, because I'm in this same situation, you know, putting money into that 403B, is I'm getting bargains. I am buying all kinds of shares that I wouldn't be able to buy if the market were higher.
That's right. And one of the hard things in times like this is you have to go between two polar opposites. You don't want to look at the situation we're in right now and project that out for the next 15, 20 years.
All right, next we have Lynn from Midland, Michigan. And boy, talk about trust. Her dad worked for Ford in the tractor division about 40 years. She grew up in a family that was totally loyal to one company.
My mom and dad always had this philosophy, Ford was good to them, so they're going to stand by them through thick and thin, no matter what. I've told them you can't do that anymore because they're not loyal to you guys, you know. They've been a great company, but you can't put all your eggs into one basket. My father has passed away, and my mother has all her cash funds into Ford Interest Advantage, which in the past has been a pretty high-yield money market fund that Ford controls. It is not FDIC insured, and my question was, she has $40,000 left, and I'm worried, should I leave it in the Ford Interest Advantage or get it out there as soon as possible?
All right. When you look at the Ford Advantage, which is like a money market mutual fund, and she's absolutely right, it's not FDIC insured, and it's yielding right now about 4.2%. So that's a nice yield. If you take a look at a money market mutual fund that invests only in U.S. Treasury securities, yield about 1.3%. In this situation, I'm a big believer, the theme of this show, who do you trust? I trust the FDIC. I trust Treasury bills. I trust Treasury inflation-protected securities. And when it's an elderly person, let's go with security. Why take the risk? 4.2%? It's not enough compensation for me, and I just think at her age, go with the government. That's who you can trust.
So, Lynn, there you go. Get out of Ford and into the U.S. government. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Okay, we are not done yet. Let's continue with some questions. And, Chris, here's a bit of a philosophical one about overseas markets.
My name is Steven. I live in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It seems that there's been a trend lately to invest in overseas markets, and I wonder what are the ramifications if a great majority of investors do absolutely that, invest in other markets as opposed to ours. Is it counterproductive to make money in markets other than our own?
Chris, I guess my first reaction is, what market are you seeing overseas that's doing well right now?
That's a good question. No, I mean, if you look at the frontier economies, they're down about 60%. The major international indexes are down about 50%, and we're down, what, 45, 46% in that range?
Down 40% is better than down 50%.
Exactly. It's, you know, right now on a relative basis, you're right, Des. It's one of the best performing markets there is, and we're all reeling with the shock of the Swiss banks are getting bailed out. I mean, it is an unprecedented time. But in terms of should you feel bad, or is it being unpatriotic, or is there something wrong with taking your money and investing it overseas? Absolutely not. Your job as an investor is to put your money where you think you're going to get the best return. If you think overseas is a better opportunity, absolutely put your money overseas. Take that risk. I applaud you. It's not necessarily a risk I'd want to be taking right now, but you know what I mean.
I certainly do. Unfortunately, that's all the time we've got this week for some questions, but you can call us anytime. Leave a question on our voicemail. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email. Go to the Getting Personal link at our website. It's marketplace.org. And Chris is also answering your questions on his blog, which you will also find at marketplace.org. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
You're welcome, Tess.
Author Margaret Atwood is known for her dystopian novels like The Handmaid's Tale and The Blind Assassin. Well, it doesn't get much more dystopic than today's economic climate. Unfortunately, it's real, not fantasy. And Atwood's new book has something to say about it. What do you think about predictions that this time we will change our habits?
Cackle, cackle, cackle. Halloween is coming.
Margaret Atwood gets her shot at the question, who can you trust? It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and joining me throughout this hour of special coverage of the financial crisis is my colleague and the host of Marketplace, Kai Rizdahl. He's here to provide some perspective on the big economic picture. Like, Kai, what is the mood on Wall Street?
Lousy, I think, is the mood on Wall Street. We've been talking today about one of the worst casualties of the financial crisis, our trust. And Americans losing confidence in the stock market.
But the marketplace players are here to remind us there's always one venerable financial institution we can depend on, if it deigns to accept our business.
Honey, I'm back. It's done. I got our life savings out of the bank in cash.
Oh, thank God. Quick, stuff it in the mattress.
Okay, hold it right there, buddy boy.
Oh, my God.
The mattress is talking.
Yeah, I got something to say.
This is weird.
Shut your squawk box. You punks got some nerve coming around to old Uncle Mattress after all these years. Why don't you go put your money back in them newfangled stock markets, huh?
Look, everyone told us you were a bad investment.
They said we needed to beat inflation.
They? Who are they? If they told you to jump off a bridge, would you do it?
Actually, yeah, we kind of did.
Financially speaking.
Meanwhile, I've been right here, yearning to keep your money safe, hearing you jabber on about 401ks and IRAs and XYZ PDQs, catching your drool with my old raggedy pillows while you dreamed of 10% returns on your investment and sugar plums and...
Don't cry.
I ain't crying. But I tell you what, you want to put your money under this mattress, there's going to be some changes.
Like what?
First off, I seen you eyeing that new Craftmatic adjustable.
We were only window shopping.
Hey, I may be a mattress, but I ain't blind. From now on, I'm the only bed in this relationship. And you're going to tell the kids I ain't a trampoline. And know what else? I got an agreement now with Piggy Bank over there.
Yeah, how about feed me once in a while, you jerks?
And Mrs. Change Jar.
You have left me feeling empty.
You put some money in me, you got to put some in them. And we reserve the right to invest that cash in under-regulated mortgage-backed debt obligations, just as long as we disclose it to you in impenetrable legalese and business speak.
But that's how the banks failed.
Exactly. And then the government will bail us out.
And we'll be stuffed with billions of taxpayer dollars.
Hooray!
This is a nightmare.
Hey. You made your bed. Now lie in it. Seriously, lie in me. It's what I live for.
Rico Galliano wrote our sketch. You'll find the cast list at marketplace.org. When you think of debt, the first thing you might picture is a bill from your credit card company, your mortgage company, the electric company. But Margaret Atwood, the Booker Award-winning author and poet, sees revenge, salvation, and epic sagas of history. Her new book, Payback, is a fascinating look at why we owe and who we pay, from running up a tab at the bar to bargaining for our eternal souls. Atwood says she began thinking and writing about debt 3 years ago, well before the current crisis.
I came to it originally through literature because the 19th century novel, which I at one point studied, has a lot of money themes in it. It was the age in which capitalism was really expanding, and also from my own childhood with parents who had come through the Depression and the war. Money was one of those things, the other two being sex and religion, that you were not supposed to discuss at the dinner table. So everything that children are told not to discuss, of course, they become very curious about.
Given all the literary references that you talk about in the book, where there is just this constant cycle throughout civilization of credit and debt, what do you think about predictions that this time, we will change our habits?
Cackle, cackle, cackle. Halloween is coming.
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, the whole idea of debt and credit, you know, borrowing and lending, is based on a very fundamental human thing, and that is the sense of fairness. And the other thing is trust. If you cannot trust that the other side will be fair, that is, that you have a chance of getting repaid, you will not lend your money. And that, of course, causes credit to dry up because currency only means something when it's flowing, when the currency is a current.
Do you wonder at all if we've gone beyond the point of bothering to think about fairness? Do we either assume it is fair or do we assume it's not but engage in it anyway?
One or the other, but a positive way of looking at debt and credit is it's a glue that holds society together. I lend to you, you lend to him, he lends to her, somebody starts a business, somebody buys a house. When credit dries up completely, you have a Scrooge situation in which Scrooge has a lot of money, but he does nothing with it. He just sits on it.
The title of one of your chapters is Debt as Plot, the idea that kind of every line of debt has a story behind it.
You bet.
When the story is written about this era, what will the plot line be?
Well, I think that there's going to be a lot of digging about with metaphorical shovels before we get to the metaphorical bottom of all of this. So when the story is written, it's going to be, how did that bubble get going? What kind of substructure permitted this to happen? Who was not minding the shop? And there have been a number of them, the South Sea bubble, the dot-com bubble. It's when things inflate much beyond the capacity of whatever is propping them up to actually make good on the promises that they're holding out.
I wonder if you would mind reading a couple of sentences for me from the beginning of the book where you pose a question that seems to have led you into writing the book itself. And then I'll ask you to answer that question. It's page 6.
Okay, here we go. I knew from fairy tales such as Peter Pan that if you ceased to believe in fairies, they would drop dead. If I stopped believing in banks, would they too expire? The adult view was that fairies were unreal and banks were real. But was that true?
And did you find an answer?
The answer is that money and banks and all of these kinds of institutions that we have built up, they're all human inventions. Because money is really just a sort of monopoly token. It's not good for anything. You can't wear it, you can't eat it, you can't smoke it. Similarly with banks. Part of our belief in banks is that they're safe. If we stop believing they're safe, the bank actually vanishes because nobody will do business with it or put money into it. Wouldn't you say that's true?
I would.
Good. We agree.
Margaret Atwood, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
And let us hope we all regain some kind of faith and trust based on something solid pretty soon.
Margaret Atwood is the author, most recently, of Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth. For an extended version of our interview, visit marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thriven.com. And by gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at gather.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
When you need to sort things out in your head, you go to a trusted therapist. When you need to sort things out in your portfolio, you go to a trusted financial planner. Or these days, you might want to go to that therapist. We've gotten several questions recently from listeners who are now wondering whether they can trust the person who's helping manage their finances. So we turn to Diane Lasuse of the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors. How do you answer that?
They need to ask some specific questions. How is my plan doing? Are we on track? Considering the world has kind of been turned upside down for all of us, what they need to do is either figure out why they're uncomfortable, or if they can't get those answers, then they may want to consider their relationship with their advisor.
What are some other things that you might want to watch out for in this time of uncertainty that should cause you to second-guess your financial planner?
Well, the things that you really need to think about are, have you gotten communication from your advisor?
So proactive communication, then. They're coming to you saying we need to talk.
Absolutely. They need to be hearing from their advisor what they think's going on in the world. Are they identifying issues that they need to talk about? They really need to be telling them what their thinking is.
And what if you have a financial planner who's essentially just kind of telling you, oh, don't worry about it, things are going to be fine?
Well, I think they probably need to be telling you more than that. They need to be talking about the issues that are going on right now, and they need to be talking about how that can affect you both in the short term and in the long term. You know, obviously, most of us are saying we're focused on the long term. And that's what we want to do, because these short-term insane markets are just that. They are short-term insane markets. But we still have to talk about all those issues. You know, what's going to happen with the banking system? What are the things that we can watch that can make us more comfortable?
If you have this conversation and decide that you may have some new trust issues with your financial planner for whatever reason, what's the best way to find a new one?
Basically, what you want to look for in financial advisors, if you're looking to change, they could be a certified financial planner, they could be a CPA who has gotten additional experience or education in financial planning. You also want to make sure they have experience. If you have more complex issues, you want to make sure they've worked with people that are like you and then have some of your same issues. You also want to make sure they have continuing education, that every year they go to courses, they stay on top of what's going on, and that you can be confident that they will continue to do that.
Diane Lassus heads up the National Association of Personal Finance Advisors. Thanks so much for coming in.
You're very welcome.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
All through the program today, we've been asking, what are you doing? Have you changed the way you saved or invested? We've heard from a former labor secretary and a cartoon editor. Now we turn the mic over to a Marketplace Money listener for our series, Here's What I'm Doing.
Hello, my name is Lita Powell Drake, sometimes called Lita of Lincoln. That's Nebraska, of course. And here's what I'm doing. I'm a senior, I'm a single woman, and I have no pension. So I really rely on my Social Security, and I have a small income from a part-time job. Every Nebraskan listens to the Oracle of Omaha, Warren Buffett, and he says, only look at your portfolio once per year, and so I'm taking his advice. I am probably the most frugal of the frugals. I still save plastic bags and string, so therefore, I've been okay. Last year, I took a strong, hard look at my savings. I decided that, yes, I could retire comfortably. Now, the bottom has fallen out. I've heard about the economy going down, of course. It makes me a little concerned. However, philosophically speaking, and as Alfred P. Newman, that other sage, would say, what? Me worried? Yes, I am worried.
That was Lita Powell Drake.
Surely you've seen those ads for AIG. They were in rotation for a while.
Did you have a nightmare?
No, I'm worried about this family's financial future. Does your retirement plan provide predictability of income and protection against market risk?
Fast forward to the punchline.
The AIG companies, the strength to be there.
Yeah, not so much. AIG got an $85 billion loan from the federal government and went back to the trough a couple of weeks later. Is your policy safe with your insurance company? Here's Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott.
So after all that drama with AIG, can you trust your insurance company? The experts I talked to said probably. Eric DiNallo is New York State's top insurance regulator. He says for one thing, AIG is not your average insurer.
I think AIG was unique in that it was not really an insurance company by the time events hit the wall. It was the largest financial services company in the world.
One of its subsidiaries in London invested in securities that blew up and destroyed AIG's balance sheet. Robert Hartwig is president of the Insurance Information Institute. It's an industry trade group. He says he doesn't know of any other company that made mistakes like AIG's. Hartwig says insurers have an advantage over banks right now. They don't borrow as much money to fund their businesses.
Insurance companies are not suffering from a liquidity crisis or a credit crisis like the banks are. If you want a policy today, it will be written. If you have a claim that needs to be paid, even a very large claim, it will be paid today.
That doesn't mean your insurance company hasn't lost money on its own investments. Insurers take the money we pay in premiums and invest it in stocks, bonds, and all kinds of other securities that you really don't want me to talk about right now. As we all know, many of those assets are worth a lot less today than they were a few months ago. Bob Hunter is director of insurance for the Consumer Federation of America. He says many life insurance companies are invested in, yes, mortgage-backed securities.
If some of those mortgages go under, in other words, if people beyond the subprime start losing their homes because of drops in valuations and so on, then it could affect some life insurance companies.
Hunter says such losses could drag some insurers under. If that happens, your policy has a lifeline. Each state has a guarantee fund that works a bit like FDIC insurance at a bank. The coverage varies from state to state, so it's still possible you could lose money. Glenn Daly is a consultant who helps individuals make insurance decisions. He says whatever you do, don't freak out. If you switch your insurance policy to another company, you may end up paying more in fees. If you pull your money out altogether, you may have to pay taxes.
You really can lose money if you panic. It's much less likely that you're going to lose money if you don't panic, if you stay put, if you chill out and take a deep breath.
Ready? Better? In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
We started this week's special program with one question. Who can you trust? Banks, brokerage houses, financial planners, government leaders? Who can you trust with your money? What we found is there's a lot of anxiety out there, but that doesn't change one simple rule. Trust is earned.
Right. And one of the ways you earn that trust is by delivering on your promises. We saw that during the Great Depression with FDR. And we're going to see it again after the election in a couple of weeks. But in the meanwhile, you have to trust yourself with your money.
Ask questions of your banks. Check your insurance policies. Make sure your financial planner is following your directions. Thanks so much for joining us, Kai.
Tess, great to be here.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, facing foreclosure can make you do crazy things like trust a scam artist who says he'll save you.
You just see the help. You don't see the consequences.
Meanwhile, if you're looking for more resources to learn about the financial crisis, head to marketplace.org. You'll find links to special coverage across all Marketplace programs, including the After the Bell podcast, our take on the week's big business stories. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali, with Jim Wallace, Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Special thanks this week to Megan Larson and Susie Lechtenberg. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.